But we never did agree on politics, he reminded her. I can trust you, Dan. The others all have their own axes to grind. I can rely on you even when we don't agree. We'd be at each other's throats the first day. She replied, I was thinking more about the first night. Dan held her tightly, inhaling the scent of her, feeling her hair brushing against his cheek. Once he had loved her, or thought he had, while she had been married to his closest friend. Now, as he stood with her pressing against him, he saw Lucita in his mind's vision. Her dark, somber eyes, her waif's face, sad and vulnerable. It won't work, Jane, he whispered. Her body stiffened. She pulled away from him. We'd end up hating each other inside of a week, he said. Besides, he added carelessly, what kind of a reputation do you think we'd get? You keeping a lover in the White House? And can you see me as a kept man? She did not smile. Yes, I can see you as a kept man. Kept in prison. Dan realized he was dealing with an explosively volatile woman now. I could even see you being shot by the security guards, Jane said, coldly furious. You came here under an alias. You're determined to undermine everything that I'm working for. Maybe shooting you here and now would be the best thing. He made himself grin. It would save the Russians the trouble. Her green eyes snapping at him, Jane said, I ought to do it. I ought to get rid of you once and for all. You've been nothing but trouble for me. Maybe you're right, he admitted. Maybe it would save us all a lot of misery. She huffed angrily. You're impossible. You've always been impossible. She stamped to the door. Jane, he called. She turned, bitter rage blazing from her eyes. Whatever I do, Dan said, it's because I still consider myself an American despite everything that's happened. You're a fool, she said, and I'm an even bigger one. She left Dan standing alone amid the Victorian furniture in the little sitting room. Within moments, an elderly butler stepped through the open doorway, his parchment wrinkled face looking sleepy and apologetic at the same time. He was small, bald, and slightly bent, as if bowing was a permanent habit with him. The President wants you to sleep in the Lincoln bedroom, the old man said, gesturing stiffly. Dan followed him back into the hall. The butler opened the heavy door of the bedroom and stood to one side. Dan saw a mammoth rosewood bed, Victorian tables with ornately carved legs, topped with marble, a portrait of Lincoln next to the bed. His travel bag had been deposited on the sofa that sat in the middle of the room. Lincoln never slept in this room, the butler said as Dan stepped in. He used this as an office. He signed the Emancipation Proclamation in here. The old man showed him the connecting bathroom, the light switches, and the television set hidden behind draperies opposite the huge bed. Dan thanked him and was glad to see him leave. Feeling very tired, Dan went to his travel bag and began to unpack his toiletries. Then his eye caught a framed set of three pieces of paper covered with handwriting. He went to the wall and studied the patient, forceful pen strokes. 47 years ago, our fathers brought forth upon this continent a new nation. A dull, rumbling sound seemed to shake the room slightly, a roar almost like the distant thunder of a rocket lifting off. Dan went to the window and pulled the curtains back. The windows were double-paned with thick, shatter-resistant plastic that was almost soundproof. Almost. But the noise from outside leaked through. The riot police had arrived in squadrons of armored vehicles that were spraying streams of vile-looking greenish gas at the crowds of picketers. People were screaming, running. Placards dropped to the pavement as they tried to escape the tracked vehicles lumbering down upon them. Where the gas reached them, they doubled over, fell to the ground, retching, coughing, spasming. Blazing searchlights played over the seething mass of people as platoons of helmeted foot soldiers linked arms to form a cordon that stretched far out into Lafayette Square and up New York Avenue. Dan reached down and picked the remote TV control unit from the bed table. One button drew back the draperies and turned on the set. The tube showed an old movie. Impatiently, Dan clicked from one channel to another. Nothing about the riot. The 24-hour news channel was showing a tape of the president's press conference from the day before. Jane looked cool and totally in command of herself as she spoke about new government programs that would stabilize employment and revitalize American agriculture. For half an hour, Dan watched the troops gassing and clubbing the picketers, dragging them away into huge waiting vans while the TV showed nothing of the riot at all. No bulletins broke the regular programming. Looking through the window, Dan could see television trucks out there among the army vehicles. Squinting against the hard glare of the searchlights, though, he saw that even the TV trucks were painted olive green. Army. There would be no media coverage of the riot, nor of the arrest and detention of several hundred picketers. The last of the heavy, tracked vehicles rumbled away. Cleaning crews drove up in big garbage trucks to make the area look neat and unblemished before the sun rose. Dan let the curtain fall and turned away from the window. His eye caught the Gettysburg draft framed on the wall. Testing whether this nation, or any nation so conceived and so dedicated, can long endure. Jane would be re-elected, all right. Dan was certain of it. And she would guide the nation down the path of least resistance, telling herself and the American people that time was on their side, that all they had to do was grit their teeth and bear their present pain and humiliation, and someday in the rosy future, the Soviets would mend their ways, and the whole world would be free and happy. Dan made up his mind to get out of Washington, out of the USA as early as possible the next morning. Chapter 27. "There she is," said Carstairs. Dan's eyes flicked open. He felt a moment of confusion. "Was I sleeping?" he muttered. "Snoring lightly," answered the Australian. Dan tried to rub his eyes and bumped his gloved hands against his helmet visor. Blinking the sleep away, he peered out through the flitter's canopy and saw the Soviet ore freighter, looming huge and close, a giant hollow sphere, a thin shell of metal that could split apart to disgorge tons of lunar rock and soil, the raw materials of all space industries. A massive, perfectly round egg floating through empty space, with a big red star painted on it above the letters CCCP. "Soyuz Sovyetskaya Socialistic Republic," Dan muttered. "That's an awful accent you've got," Zlotnik's voice teased in his helmet earphones. "Sure, and I don't intend to learn any better either," Dan growled. Carstairs piloted the flitter close to the bulky ore carrier, then maneuvered their spacecraft to circle all the way around it. This close, it looked to Dan like a world of its own, bright sunlight glinting off its curving flank. "God," muttered the Australian, "it's huge!" "It's almost as if they hung it there to tempt us," said Zlotnik, "like they want us to steal it." "We're not stealing," Dan snapped. "We are claiming natural resources that are the common heritage of all humankind, and therefore belong to no single nation." He heard Zlotnik's answering snicker. "Yeah, and we're doing it when the Russians aren't looking." Vargas, the young Venezuelan, who was usually as silent as a rock, said, "We are expropriating the expropriators." "Paco," Carstairs said with mock surprise, "was that you?" "Reciting from Marx," Zlotnik added. "My father is a member of the Communist Party of Venezuela," the young astronaut said. "I learned Marx and the Bible at the same time." "No time for religion now," said Carstairs, "or for chat." The Aussie's gloved fingers played deftly across the control panel keyboard. With microscopic puffs of thrust, the needle-shaped flitter matched its speed and trajectory to that of the massive Soviet freighter. Like a tiny pin chasing a fat, round balloon, Dan thought. "No crew pod in sight," Carstairs muttered. "No radiator fins or any other signs of a life support system," said Zlotnik. "She's unmanned." "I pick up two transponders," Vargas added, his eyes on the electronics control panel in front of him. "They are signaling at the usual Soviet frequencies, just as all the others do, nothing out of the ordinary." Dan turned the radar scan to maximum range and studied the orange glowing screen in front of him. "No other spacecraft in view. She's unescorted." "Ours for the taking," said Carstairs. For half an instant, Dan hesitated. Then he said, "Okay, let's get to work." Carstairs pressed his thumb against the button that actuated the canopy release, and the glass bubble silently, smoothly swung up and away from the cockpit. One by one, the four astronauts unlatched their safety harnesses, floated out of their seats, and clambered slowly, hand over hand, along the grips that studded the latticework midsection of the spacecraft. From the equipment pods there, they detached one-man maneuvering units, which looked rather like high-back chairs minus the seats. Dan strapped himself into one of the jet backpacks slowly, with deliberate care.